Chapter 4. Pavlov's Quest. For more than 30 years, from 1903 until his death in early 1936, Pavlov pursued his quest to understand the mysteries of the human psyche, to constrain it within deterministic, mechanistic law. Psychic secretion now became conditional reflex, CR, but it also remained psychic secretion. For Pavlov, the CR and the idiosyncratic psyche were two dimensions of the same phenomenon, for which he adopted the term higher nervous activity. He sought not the replacement of one with the other, but rather their fusion, slitye, the fusion of the objective and subjective, the physiological and psychological. If one gives them their psychological term, he announced as he launched this research, the phenomena of the conditional reflex are precisely associations. For Pavlov, the CR was both a phenomenon and, even more important, a method for analyzing the underlying mechanisms of personality, learning, expectation, emotions, and all the qualities that he had long associated with psychic secretion and that many psychologists attributed to associations. Over the next decades, he and his co-workers would pay even greater attention to the psychological qualities of their dogs than they had during research on digestion. They would discover that dogs were heroic and cowardly, crafty and dull, diligent and lazy, freedom-loving and passive, mentally robust, fragile, and diseased. Pavlov enunciated this goal clearly and consistently. He informed the International Congress of Physicians in Madrid in 1903 that he was determined, sooner or later, to bring the objective results of CR experiments to our own subjective world as well, and this will at once and brightly illuminate our mysterious nature, elucidating the mechanism and the real-life meaning of that which occupies the human mind increasingly more persistently, man's consciousness, the torments of his consciousness. In his Nobel Prize speech 1 year later, he repeated his intention to bring the strictly objective methods of natural science to bear upon the one thing that interests us in life, our own psychic content. Speaking to London scientists and physicians in 1906, he expressed confidence that the objective material of CR experiments would provide the basis of psychological knowledge, and so a significant part of the real answer to those torturous questions which have occupied and tormented human beings since time immemorial. 2 decades into his investigations, writing after the carnage of the World War and Russia's Civil War, he introduced his 20 years' experience of the objective study of higher nervous activity, 1923, with these same sentiments. Man, driven by some dark forces acting within him, causes himself incalculable material losses and indescribable sufferings through the horrors of wars and revolutions that send him back to bestiality. Only the last science, the exact science about man himself, and the most reliable approach to it is via the road of the almighty natural science, will guide him out of the current darkness and cleanse him of all the present indignity in the sphere of interhuman relations. To follow Pavlov's research trajectory, we must constantly bear in mind the nature of his objective data, the saliva drops generated by thousands of CR experiments, and his goal, an explanation of the mysteries of the psyche. The path he envisioned to get from one to the other, or rather to accomplish their fusion, can be broken down into 3 basic steps. First, discover the presumably fully determined regularities in the salivation elicited by thousands of experiments on the formation, variation, and extinction of CRs. Second, use these regularities, patterns, to build a model of the unseen processes in the higher nervous system that produced them. Third, and finally, use that model to explain the behavior, affect, psychological experiences, and personality of experimental animals, and ultimately, humans. In practice, these 3 steps proceeded in parallel over the course of 3 decades, with each set of conclusions constantly being revised and compelling changes in the other two. As in his digestive research, but on a qualitatively greater scale in the 1920s and 1930s, Pavlov pursued his grand vision through the coordinated labor of an army of co-workers in specially equipped labs. In his talks and articles of the early 1900s, Pavlov discussed a number of step one regularities. If the experimenter exposed the dog to a previously neutral stimulus that acted on its sense organs, the beat of a metronome, a flashing light, electrical shock, and fed the dog or exposed it to acid at the same time, this created a conditional stimulus, CS, that produced the same reflexive response, a salivary secretion, as did the feeding or acid, the unconditional stimulus, or US itself. That CS was weakened, elicited fewer saliva drops, if used at the same time as another neutral stimulus. A strong stimulus, such as a buzzer, became a CS more quickly and elicited greater salivation than a weak stimulus, such as a flashing light. This became the law of strength. If one CS elicited, say, 5 drops of saliva, and a second CS elicited 4 drops, the two would, in principle, elicit 9 drops of saliva if deployed simultaneously, the law of summation. If a metronome, CS, was repeatedly sounded without presentation of food, the US, its beat eventually ceased to elicit salivation. It had become not merely neutral, but a conditional inhibitor, CI. So if it was now sounded simultaneously with an active CS, the combination elicited less salivation than that CS alone. On closer inspection, even these relatively simple regularities revealed complexities and variations, and so questions requiring interpretation and further research. Why did two dogs respond to the same CS with differing amounts of saliva? Why did it take 15 repetitions of the metronome without reinforcement for this CS to become extinct in one dog, but 45 in another? For Pavlov, every drop of saliva must have a mechanistic explanation. So each variation provided a starting point for new experiments, for the discovery of additional laws. The differences between dogs' performance in identical experiments, to take an especially important example, was addressed systematically in the 1920s and 1930s by investigations of nervous types. These studies of the CR as a phenomenon shaded seamlessly into the use of the CR as a method for step two, constructing a model of the unseen nervous processes that underlay experimental results. What exactly transpired in the higher nervous system when a CR was formed and extinguished? What were the precise mechanisms and properties of the dog's analyzers? This was Pavlov's term for the unified nervous mechanism, beginning with the sensory apparatus and ending in the brain, through which the animal received information about the external world. Pondering such questions, Pavlov developed models to explain the salivary patterns generated by increasingly complex experiments. One important example that originated in the first decade of CR research was what Pavlov termed differentiation, the physiological dimension of the psychologist's discrimination. The basic experiment was simple. The experimenter sets a metronome beating at 60 strokes per minute, M60, and feeds the dog. After a number of repetitions, the hungry animal salivates consistently to that sound. The metronome has become a CS, and a CR has been formed. During each trial, the experimenter measures the amount of salivation to gauge its strength. These trials were conducted largely by the first generation of women co-workers in Pavlov's lab, now slows the metronome to 40 beats per minute, M40, and does not feed the dog. Initially, the dog salivates to the sound of the slower beat, but after a number of repetitions, it ceases to do so. M60 has remained a CS, but M40 has become a CI. In the years before World War I, the lab used such experiments to determine the acuity of the dog's sense of time and its ability to distinguish among colors, distances, temperatures, shapes, and different points on its body. Differentiation experiments also contributed to the lab's developing model of higher nervous processes. Why, just after M60 was established as a CS, did the beating of the metronome at any speed initially elicit salivation? And why, after a series of repetitions during which only M60 was reinforced with feeding, did the dog cease to salivate in response to any speed other than M60? Pavlov concluded that any stimulus initially irradiates across the entire cerebral cortex, leading to general excitation, and only then, in a second phase, concentrates at one particular point. He also reasoned that this process of differentiation resulted from the struggle and collision of what he viewed as co-equal nervous processes, excitation and inhibition. Thus, the beating of the reinforced M60 excited the entire cerebral cortex. But, after a series of trials in which other speeds were not reinforced by feeding, these other speeds became CIs and generated an inhibitory wave that suppressed excitation at all speeds other than M60. The ability of the dog to differentiate between M60 and M40 then depended, according to lab doctrine by the 1910s, on the collision and struggle of excitatory and inhibitory processes. That model changed in 1922, when a particularly talented and determined coworker, Dmitry Fursikov, convinced Pavlov that discordant data, which had been underplayed and explained away to save the collision and struggle model, supported a more dialectical view of mutual induction between excitation and inhibition. The final, climatic step three in Pavlov's agenda was to integrate that model of nervous processes with the behavior, effect, and psychological experiences of his experimental animals, and ultimately, of humans. That is, to fuse the two dimensions of higher nervous activity. How did he seek to traverse the great interpretive distance from step two to the torments of human consciousness to achieve, as he put it confidently in 1932, a merger of the psychological and the physiological, of the subjective and the objective? This question takes us to the heart of his scientific style and the meaning for him of the term objective. For Pavlov, the objectivity of his approach resided in two of its characteristics. It proceeded on the basis of a concrete, measurable, physiological phenomenon, salivation, and he moved interpretively from this objective phenomenon to the subjective realm. This he opposed to subjective psychological methodologies that proceeded from postulates about the animal's internal subjective world. His notion of objectivity, then, most emphatically did not mean, contrary to a common misconception and to the American behaviorism of his day, that he doubted the existence of the subjective psyche, discounted its importance, believed that scientists should focus only on external behaviors, or himself proposed to ignore the subjective realm. He put it bluntly at a meeting with coworkers. It would be stupid to reject the subjective world. It clearly exists, of course. Psychology, as a formulation of the phenomena of our subjective world, is an entirely legitimate thing, and it would be blind to quarrel with it. The question is, how to analyze this subjective world? In the early years of his research, Pavlov famously banished subjectivist formulations from the lab. We strictly forbade ourselves, we even had fines imposed in our laboratory, to use such psychological expressions as the dog figured it out, it now intends, it now desires, and so on. Finally, all the phenomena we were interested in appeared before us in a different light. He replaced psychological terms with physiological ones. For example, teasing became excitation at a distance, and pain became destructive irritation. In that same spirit, he referred in articles and talks to so-called psychic and so-called duchevne, literally of the soul, phenomena. And by the early 1920s, he banished those words from his lexicon as well, replacing them with two well-considered terms. First, higher nervous activity, which served as an umbrella for both physiological processes, excitation, inhibition, irradiation, concentration, and so forth, and the so-called psychic, or so-called duchevnie, that constituted their subjective dimension. Second, beginning in 1923, in a bit of outreach to the American behaviorists whom he considered his most promising audience among psychologists, he equated higher nervous activity with behavior. Yet he defined that latter word quite differently than did the behaviorists. For Pavlov, behavior encompassed both the organism's external and its internal, including subjective, responses to its environment. The banishing of subjective terminology proved brief. Once he had established a physiological lexicon and model of higher nervous processes through which he could approach the dog's affect and behavior objectively, subjective language and anthropomorphic descriptions of lab dogs became central to his research. Indeed, these constituted his principal explanatory target. This was most evident in informal conversations with coworkers and in comments to unintimidating audiences, such as the Society of Russian Physicians and the general public, particularly after exciting experimental results achieved with coworkers Maria Erofeva and Maria Bezbokhaya in 1911-12 bolstered Pavlov's confidence that he was on the road to a grand physiology of mind and emotion. In Erofeva's experiments, after an electrical shock was repeatedly paired with feeding, the hungry animal eventually responded to the shock with salivation rather than an avoidance reaction. Even when ratcheted up to painful levels, shock, the experimenters concluded, had become a CS. This, Pavlov enthused in informal conversations, including one with visiting British physiologist Charles Sherrington, demonstrated how the Christian martyrs endured terrible torture and did so smiling. Just as Erofeva's dog was so hungry that it responded to electrical shock paired with food as a CS, so did the Christians smile while enduring terrible torture because their enormous moral excitation eliminated the feeling of pain. In professional presentations, his interpretations were much more restrained. In Bezbokhaya's research, the experimenters used an electrical rod and the dog's learned hostility toward Pavlov to keep the animal in a state of rage and study how that anger influenced its CRs. For Pavlov, this experimental investigation of emotions, by clearly revealing the dog's heightened salivary responses when behaving aggressively, explained why a person consumed by passion, for example, jealousy, blames his unhappiness on an innocent person, or even on an inanimate object. As his research developed, Pavlov became increasingly confident and explicit in these interpretive habits, fusing physiological and psychological processes through analogy and moving easily between explanations of dogs and humans. This is especially striking in his articles The Purpose Reflex, 1916, and The Freedom Reflex, 1917, in three public addresses of 1918, in which he used lab experiments to analyze Russia's catastrophic plight. Publications about nervous types and psychiatry in the 1920s and 1930s, his lab notebooks, recorded meetings with coworkers, and informal comments throughout the 1920s and 1930s. Pavlov, like Darwin, believed firmly in the continuity of the human psyche with that of higher organisms, and he constantly related the behavior and affect of his experimental dogs to that of his human acquaintances and to himself. Co-worker Mats Gubergritz noticed in 1915 that during the experiments that led Pavlov to his concept of the freedom reflex, the chief frequently compared the lab dogs with characters from literature, especially from the works of his favorite writers. Addressing the law-governedness of mental life and the connection between the scientific laboratory and life, 1931, Pavlov used the travails of a lab dog to analyze the mental breakdown of his old friend Bistroff at St. Petersburg University. Just as the dog's unbearable torment when confronted with experimental tasks too complex for its nervous constitution elicited barking and howling as if it were being cruelly tortured, so Bistroff's inability to master the complex principles and procedures of university science studies resulted in the difficult, tormented state of his hemispheres during their work. In both dog and man, this resulted in melancholy with excitation. His favorite subject for such anthropomorphic reflection was himself. During experiments, he frequently commented about similarities between the animal's responses and his own sensations and experiences. "That which I see in dogs," he explained to one reporter, "I immediately transfer to myself, since, you know, the basics are identical." This was both a way to understand the experiments themselves, of reasoning from observable patterns of salivation to the unseen higher nervous processes that lay behind them and the subjective experiences that these produced, and an effort to understand himself scientifically. Such canine-inspired musings included reflections about his nervous type, his style of thought, the influence of aging on the relative strength of his excitatory and inhibitory processes, and so, on his thinking, his self-experimentation on free will, and his memories of his favorite deceased son. The lab's experimental protocols incorporated this same anthropomorphic perspective. As research took off and Pavlov standardized experimental note-taking, co-workers recorded not only the time of the trial, the nature of the exciter used, and the amount of salivation generated, but also, in a final column, other observations. These routinely included such information as the dog ate greedily, reacted defensively or aggressively, exhibited negativism, or sighed. By the early 1920s, dogs were characterized according to their nervous type and described using the full panoply of human characteristics. In one 1933 article for Pavlov's closely edited House Journal, a leading co-worker described his dog as an opportunistic sycophant who knows how to serve. Pondering the lab dog Pingle in the early 1930s, Pavlov jotted in his notebook a Napoleonic type. When free, that is when not strapped to the experimental stand, extremely mobile and greedy. In the stand, very peaceful, almost motionless, a small and inconsistent secretory reaction to conditional stimuli. A positive movement reaction to food is almost absent. Approaches the food trough haltingly and in a demonstratively very slow manner. Then eats greedily and licks its chops for a very long time, even licking its feet. The goal of his grand quest was to understand the higher nervous processes that produced this greedy, aggressive, and crafty Napoleonic creature, and by extension, Napoleon himself. Pavlov's holy grail, then, was the conceptual integration of physiological and psychological phenomena, which he attempted to accomplish by identifying patterns in the formation, variation, and extinction of CRs. By developing a conceptual model of the higher nervous processes that generated those patterns, and by using that model to explain behaviors, personalities, and various subjective states. The fundamental criterion of success remained the same as in his digestive research: the ability to encompass, contain, and so explain experimental phenomena by a limited number of basic principles. In her memoirs, Petrova captured perfectly the logical consistency in the evolution from the early Pavlov, who banished subjective terminology, to the later Pavlov, who employed such terminology unapologetically. He ceased to fear psychological terms, since he felt the strength to call them to battle, to confront a new reality, and through this confrontation, to discover the path of further work. The goal of the entire enterprise revealed itself at the moment when victory was assured and the unity of the system became obvious to all. As for the ontological relationship between physiological and psychological processes, Pavlov took a reserved, positivist position. In the early 1900s, he briefly participated in a study group that discussed philosophical theories about the mind-body relationship, but soon quit, preferring to study the factual aspect of that question. He did, however, continue to ponder this question privately, jotting in his lab notebook around 1912 that we consider all so-called psychic activity to be a function of the brain mass, of a defined mechanism, that is, of an object conceived spatially. But how can one place upon this mechanism an activity that is conceived psychologically, that is, non-spatially? A believer in free will and personal responsibility, and himself extraordinarily goal-directed, Pavlov also continually reflected about how to define such freedom and reconcile it with mechanistic determinism and the dynamics of CRs. In professional settings and publications, he adopted the positivist stance that he, like Bernard and Sion, considered appropriate for a scientist. When pressed by his audience at Petrograd's Philosophical Society in 1916 about how, precisely, knowledge of CRs would explain psychological experiences, Pavlov acknowledged that the relationship between nervous phenomena and the subjective world is quite complex, and to move from one to the other is very difficult. Conceding that he knew little about the various theories, he insisted that this was unimportant. "I have always limited myself only to practice, methods. I cannot agree that my approach represents pure materialism. I am only pursuing an approach useful for investigation." Pavlov maintained a positivist faith that the accumulation of facts over time would itself eventually illuminate the precise relationship between nervous processes and the subjective realm. In the meantime, in practice, he looked for parallels between the nervous processes transpiring, according to his model, during CR experiments on the one hand, and the behavior, affect, and personality of experimental animals on the other, and explained the latter as an expression of the former. Cowardice was the result of chronic overinhibition. Negativism was the psychological expression of the ultra-paradoxical phase in higher nervous activity, during which a CS produced an inhibitory response and a CI produced an excitatory response, and so forth. Pavlov's quest set him on an exciting and fruitful three-decade journey to the horizon. He discovered much interest along the way. Facts, methodologies, relationships, and insights of enduring value. But the ultimate destination continually receded behind an endless landscape of new and perplexing complexities. He was frequently excited and heartened by experiments that produced satisfyingly consistent results and surprising discoveries, the development of new and powerful explanatory principles, the revelation of new research perspectives, and indications that his research might have clinical value, for example, in the analysis and treatment of mental illness. Yet he was also frequently disheartened, even depressed, as the much-trumpeted results and interpretations of earlier experiments were overturned and apparently solid ground dissolved, as the experimental data, and so the psyche, failed to conform to even increasingly elaborate mechanistic models. Pavlov always responded to these doubts with new experiments, and a single encouraging result sufficed to restore his enthusiasm and confidence. The journey was long, but surely he was on the right path. But therein resided the paradox of his quest. In true positivist spirit, he was convinced that the more experiments he and his co-workers conducted, the more facts they collected, and the more patterns they were therefore able to establish, the closer he would come to his goal. Experimental data would reveal a set of basic laws and a model of higher nervous activity that would, in turn, explain the behavior, personality, and affect of his dogs, and eventually, humans. As he put it in a discussion with co-workers about the vexing question of the dynamics of excitation and inhibition, "We elicit various conditions under which the excitatory and inhibitory processes manifest themselves. Everything comes down to this. The time will come, and it will be such a wonderful moment, when suddenly everything becomes clear, when we will know precisely all the conditions that elicit the process and weaken it." Yet, just the opposite proved true. Over the years, as his lab enterprise expanded and the number of coworkers, dogs, and experiments swelled, the resultant avalanche of data overwhelmed and defeated his every attempt at systematization. Experimental results simply would not fit snugly into even the most imaginative framework. More experiments, in other words, just compounded the problem. Pavlov's interpretive response to these confounding junctures was always to enlarge the explanatory frame by introducing a new variable that might resolve discrepancies. Here, he followed the lead of eminent French physiologist Claude Bernard. Determinism presumably reigned. So, if the same experiment produced varied results, there must be some uncontrolled variable. Pavlov thought in broad biological terms about CRs and the nervous system, viewing them as means through which organisms maintained balance both as an integrated whole and in relationship to a changing environment. Constantly imagining the dog in its experimental stand as an animal or human in nature and society, he regularly introduced new variables from the broader world beyond the lab. Thus enriched, his explanations continually expanded in scope at the cost of precision and refutability. This dynamic defined the underlying logic of Pavlov's investigations as they unfolded over three decades, imparting power, paradox, and pathos to his quest. The five basic principles through which he attempted unsuccessfully to contain his experimental data when he first tried to write a monograph on CRs in 1917-21 expanded constantly over subsequent years. For example, the fact that different dogs required differing numbers of trials to form and extinguish CRs, combined with their observably different personalities, gave rise in the 1920s to the doctrine of nervous types. Delineation of the various nervous types would, presumably, explain the varied responses of different dogs to the same experiment. Yet, experiments designed to establish a typology continually revealed more discrepancies and more variables. So, the number of differing nervous types grew from 3 to more than 25. And still, the data were not contained, nor did the results of CR experiments map neatly onto his animals' personalities. His attempt to encompass contradictory data through new variables drawn from a broader biological and social perspective generated new basic principles and lines of investigation on the relationship between excitation and inhibition, the phases of hypnosis and sleep, the interplay of nature and nurture, mental illness in dogs and humans, and the analytical and synthetic qualities of the cortex. Each expansion of the interpretive frame produced valuable observations and insights. Each revealed new perspectives that excited the chief and urged him on, and each failed to bring him and his companions any closer to the horizon. Pavlov's visit to the West in 1923 whetted the appetite of his foreign admirers, who pressed him for a synthetic monograph. Having tried and failed to write one earlier, he had instead, as a temporary solution, published his talks and articles in 20 Years' Experience of the Objective Study of Higher Nervous Activity, 1923. Now he tried again, but again found his manuscript unsatisfactory, discarding page after page and launching major revisions. He finally completed the book, only under duress. Gleb Anrep, a former co-worker, now serving as a reader in physiology at University College London, delivered a series of lectures about CRs to audiences in England and the United States. In a clearly orchestrated effort, Pavlov's closest Western colleagues informed him excitedly about the great interest in those lectures and suggested that, in the absence of a monograph by Pavlov himself, Anrep might write one. Would Pavlov, they asked, object to that? Thus motivated, he accepted funding from London's Royal Society and began sending manuscript chapters to Anrep, who served as translator. The Russian and English editions both appeared in 1927. In order not to undercut readership for this volume, publication of the English edition of 20 Years was postponed until 1928. Composed reluctantly at a time when uncertainties were mounting and his ideas were in flux, Pavlov's lectures on the work of the cerebral hemispheres of the brain lacked the elegance and powerful argumentation of his earlier lectures on the work of the main digestive glands. This volume, rather, captured the state of his research perfectly, offering a compelling general vision and a wide range of intriguing experimental findings, but no synthesis of the two. The first two lectures explained his basic vision and approach. Lectures 3 through 10 presented the basic picture of higher nervous processes as Pavlov had understood them in 1921, and lectures 11 through 18 were devoted to the contradictions, complexities, and new lines of investigation that had emerged since. The book ended not in triumph, but in confession. Earlier, of necessity, we artificially oversimplified, schematized the subject. Now, having some knowledge of its general foundations, we are surrounded, nay, crushed, by a mass of details demanding explanation. That same besieged, confessional note pervaded Pavlov's remarks to a meeting of his co-workers in December 1926, intended to celebrate the impending publication of his book. "I must thank you for all your work, for the mass of collected facts, for having superbly subdued this beast of doubt. And now, I hope this beast will retreat from me." Periodically acknowledging his obligation to write another, genuinely synthetic monograph, he never made a serious effort to do so. The temporary solution represented by 20 years thus became permanent, and successive editions added reports and articles that recorded the experimental and conceptual developments and the constantly emerging conundrums of his later research, but without any pretense of systematizing them. Pavlov's enthusiasm for his quest remained undiminished to the end. During that last winter at Koltushi, he was enlarging the frame again, awaiting the results of a breeding experiment designed to clarify the roles of heredity and environment, and even revising his definition of the CR in light of his experiments on chimps and engagement with the insights of Gestalt psychology. "Surely," he mused just before his death, "if he could live just another 5 years, he would witness the decisive triumph of his scientific mission."